Paul writes to the church in Corinth about what is to be revealed uniquely to them. It's hard for us to imagine now the situation of the church just around the time this building was built at the turn of the last century. It was just a little before the cornerstone of this building was laid, in fact, about exactly a year before, that a man that most of you have never heard of, a man who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1946, wrote a book that became an underground bestseller on college campuses across the country. The man's name was John Raleigh Mott. And the book he wrote at the age of 36 in 1901 had a title that became a motto for a movement. The book was called The Evangelization of the World in This Generation. And it made an audacious demand. It held out the idea that every person on the planet should, in the first 20 years of the 20th century, have the chance to learn about the story of Jesus of Nazareth and the Christian faith. We cannot quite grasp today why this might have been such a compelling idea, but it was. So much so that it touched off conferences at campuses and the advent of something called the student volunteer movement. And within 10 years, it brought about the first international gathering of leaders of Protestant missionary societies from the United States and Canada and all throughout of Europe. 1,200 people in all for the first conference on global Christian mission, a meeting in Edinburgh that is seen today as the spark that led to the creation of the World Council of Churches. All of this spoke to the moment. For 80 years, at least, before 1901, deeply devoted young men and women from churches all across the United States have been traveling to places all over the world on mission trips. These were not the kind of mission trips for repairing hurricane-flooded homes or building schools in poor communities. They were launched for the specific purpose of converting souls to the Christian faith, for baptizing people and planting churches all over the world. Indeed, at just about the same time that Mott wrote his book, the headquarters of the worldwide network of American missionaries overseas was right here in Boston at number 14 Beacon Street in a building called Congregational House. And from there, the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions controlled more missionaries in the field than the State Department had diplomats. We have a sort of funny feeling about the idea of taking on as an agenda a bold commitment to proselytization, to the idea of making sure every person on the planet has a chance to hear the gospel of Christ. We are less certain, maybe, in the urgency of that idea than John Mott was. Mott and the people of his generation, who after all were the people who built this church, saw the world as a battleground between the mission of God through Christ to save souls and the spiritual forces opposed to the Christian message. And that made up a pretty big list. John Mott really believed that the problem wasn't that people didn't agree with Christianity. The problem was that they had not yet heard the message. If only they could hear the message, the grace and power of it would overcome most objection. Ignorance would give way to belief. We are less sure of that today. We are more aware of the all-too-human limitations of the missionary project. We see it as imperialistic, as culturally triumphalist, as tone-deaf to the very real spiritual traditions that existed In many of those places, missionaries went long before we ever appeared. John Mott was able to start a movement of great strength by holding up in front of a group of young people a task of seemingly urgent importance. What he said of one of his own mentors could be even better said of him. Here's the quote. "He knew how to get hold of college students. I will tell you the way to do it. And that is to place before them something which is tremendously difficult. He presented missions as a war of conquest and not as a mere wrecking expedition. It appealed to the strong college athletes and other fine spirits of the colleges because of its very difficulty. They wanted to hear more about it. It is hard to imagine anything that has that sort of impact on college students today, or on anyone else, for that matter. In the 1960s, maybe, it was the Peace Corps. And for a few brief years around the time of the attacks of September 11th, in the days that I was working in college chaplaincy, it was, believe it or not, the military. But today, about the only thing I can imagine motivating students to such high purpose would be the chance of participating in an initial public offering at the stock market. The thing is, we need high purpose. We need to feel as though we are part of something that is not just a theory, but a duty. We need to know that we are part of a great cause, of a great hope. God has made us that way, and it is a mercy that we are made that way. Without it, we become isolated and inward. We cannot imagine the possibility of progress, and we see no reason for improving our own lives or the lives of others. Our ability to give ourselves to a great cause is an adaptive advantage for our species. It bands us together across great differences and selfish interest. The problem is that we live in a moment in history in which the very possibility of great purpose is questioned. The great narratives that gave our parents and our grandparents a unifying aspiration. In our own generation, they have been dissected and scrutinized. And believe me, it is hard to keep alive something that has been dissected. We do not put much stock in spreading Christianity or democracy or Western values. We are not so eager to associate ourselves with causes. Our beliefs are for private consumption only. And we don't want to become known by them by wearing the badge of any cause that makes a claim to high purpose. It may give us comfort, or at least a kind of social security in the terms of our culture. But does it also mean that nothing we do here matters? If there are no great causes anymore, does anything depend on us? The theme of the readings appointed for this morning is the necessity, even the urgency, of proclamation. The readings speak to the duty that is laid upon us to be the messengers and not just the bystanders. Jesus delivers that message in the familiar words of Matthew about not keeping our light under a bushel. And it is no accident that Governor Winthrop used those words to describe the great purpose in view for a new commonwealth he was building in Massachusetts in 1630. Here is what he said. "We must consider that we shall be as a city on a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us." The idea of creating a true commonwealth, a community of all conditions and classes of people bound together in a common purpose, all of that depended on them. Paul delivered that message to the church he planted in Corinth, the church that was made up not of the great and eminent citizens, but of dock workers and household servants and widows and peripheral people. Paul tells them that it is to them that God will reveal things that are not just unknown, but unimagined. Unimagined in the corridors of power and wealth. But for the world to learn those things, to have a chance of discovering them, the people called into the church will have to be faithful. It depends on them. Maybe the most compelling, certainly the most beautiful, are the words of Isaiah to the faithful covenant people of his day. They are people who had had all hope of great purpose taken away from them by occupying powers and eviction from their home. They've lost their king, they've lost their nation, they've lost their temple. They are trying to restore their fortunes by getting their religion right, by saying the right words and offering the right sacrifices. And God uses Isaiah to teach them that they will not find great purpose by means of sacrifice. They will find it by means of service, by means of seeing and fixing the problems around them. People are hungry. People are homeless. People are without dignity, whether it's the dignity of clothes or the dignity of hope and purpose. Addressing those concerns, reaching out to those people in love and not just in theory, that depends on them. And that sort of action turns out to be the right kind of sacrifice, the right kind of religion, and the right kind of proclamation. So, tending to the light that will draw people toward the love of Christ, that depends on us. Keeping open for everybody the possibility of a spiritual dimension to human existence in the midst of a marketed and materialistic culture, that depends on us. And taking on the task of feeding and clothing and housing and helping and dignifying people, the hungry, the naked, the homeless, the hopeless, that depends on us. Governor Winthrop had it right. I cannot improve on his words, so here they are. We must be knit together in this work as one people. We must entertain each other in sibling affection. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities, our excesses, for the supply of others' necessities. We must uphold a familiar commerce together in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality. We must delight in each other. Make others' conditions our own. Rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our commission and community in the work as members of the same body. Fewer and fewer communities around us work that way anymore. We all know the story of growing inequality of incomes and the disappearance of the middle, the entrapping cycle of poverty. If people are going to see an example of a community of shared burdens, shared joys, shared grief, shared wealth, and shared hope, then that depends on us. And it may just be the most crucial thing we ever do.